yeah, there's going to be a house model. The house is more interesting than the fucking presidency, guys. I guess you have to bleep that.
Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk.
I'm Nate Silver.
And this is Model Talk.
The last Model Talk of 2016, I think.
2016?
2018,
damn.
Bro.
You're really time traveling there.
2018?
Do you finally feel like your 2016 election cycle is over? Is that what you're saying?
My 2016 election? Oh, yeah. Just a subliminal. Yeah. No, that will never be over.
Well, actually, do you know now whether or not we're going to have a Democratic primary forecast? Have you thought about it since last time?
We're going to put some shit out there.
Something.
I'm not sure if it'll be good or not.
All right, fair enough. So
the one thing, you know, we'll vouch for our general election forecast, the primary stuff.
You're on your own, folks.
No, I mean, I don't know, right? Again, we've joked before that I wish I could put some things in, like, Comic Sans, like, as a font, right? Because it's, like, so provisional. I kind of think our primary forecast should be in Comic Sans.
But we're going to do one, because we haven't done one in the past.
Kalen, I'm getting triggered just by you asking that question. We have had state-by-state forecasts. What we haven't had before is, like, an overall chance of winning the primary forecast.
Like a forecast that says Beto O'Rourke is going to win the Democratic primary in 2020.
There is a 1 in 14 chance that Beto
that's going to come back to haunt you.
1 in 14. Book it, guys. 1 in 14 chance. No, maybe he's going to win. That's too low. I actually think Beto's chance is probably like 1 in 5. I think he's one of the more likely ones.
Anyway, our next episode of Model Talk is when we'll get into that in earnest, which might be, you know, many months from now. So while we're here, let's talk about the model that we just finished using. This will be our sort of Model Talk post-mortem. We'll talk about where things went right, maybe where things went wrong a little bit, lessons learned. To start off, I think people know that we're generally happy with how the model performed, but let's dig a little bit more into the details. So I'm curious if you felt like the model did like particularly well in some area, avoided any traps, and then if it came up maybe short in another area.
I think it did really well. Mm-hmm. I think you can argue that it actually did too well, Galen. It did too well, man.
It overconsidered
uncertainty. It was too good. It's like the job question, right? We're like, what's your greatest weakness? And they're like, well, my greatest weakness is that I just work too hard. But like, okay.
Well, we have talked about this before in that we had more uncertainty than was maybe necessary in this election because in some elections you will get a systematic polling error.
That's the thing. So look, our forecast did really, really, really well this election. It is one election. You know, in some ways, it's 506 separate elections because you have different races in each state, but it is one election. And when we have probabilistic estimates, they're meant to account for the fact that errors and races are correlated and that you're going to have some pretty good elections, some really good elections, which is in the really good category, some pretty bad elections, and some really bad elections, right? And so it's kind of like, it's good. It was very good. But when all the polls are unbiased, right, and accurate, where it means like, okay, on average, Democrats beat their polls in some states, Republicans in other states, but there wasn't any overall bias, then that removes a lot of uncertainty. You know, a lot of the times when we have like a race at like likely Republican or likely Democrat with an 85% chance or whatever, it's because when there's a systematic polling error, all of a sudden those races that you didn't think were close all become competitive, right?
So just because this election went well, don't stop believing that uncertainty is real and that polling errors happen.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, it's encouraging in the sense that, like, so we never thought the evidence supported us in the first place, right? If you're someone who, like, oh, polls are getting worse, again, that's not true, really. Polls were about as accurate in 2016 as they have been on average in the long run. My guess is that they're going to wind up being a little above average this year, but there were some misses. I mean, they were off by quite a few points in Indiana. They were off by quite a few points in Missouri in those Senate races, for example. I'm sure we'll look at some individual House polls that were way off, although the more prolific pollsters, including our friends at the Upshot. I mean, that's one thing that helped, right, is these Upshot polls did very well, very, very well, from what I can tell. And to have a bunch of really accurate public, nonpartisan polls in House races is really nice. And that hadn't necessarily happened before. You know, usually it's very sporadic where you get like a nonpartisan poll in a House race. Monmouth did a fair amount of polling in House races too. So that was nice. There were not that many really competitive House races where we were without at least one reasonably high quality recent poll, and that's a big plus.
That actually gets at one question that we got from a listener, Matt. We'll just go to it now. He said, it seems like statewide polls did worse than district polls. Points to examples like Missouri, Indiana, maybe Florida. Does that hint at trouble reaching certain GOP voters in solid Republican districts that were not polled for House races?
Well, there are also other, you know, Nevada, the polls were low on Rosen, who won by 5-ish points. And some of the polls were a little low on Beto, actually. And so there do seem to be patterns where the more diverse states polls seem to lowball Democrats. California, we're going to take a look at, too. Some of the polls early in the cycle were low on Democrats in California, where they kind of won all the races that they had a chance to win. And California's a state now where you've had errors a couple of years in a row. I mean, yeah, look, I mean, if you want to get more scientific about it, like, there do seem to be these kind of somewhat consistent polling errors, but which direction they pull on and tug on depends on the year and which side prevails. I mean, it does seem like in very red, rural, white states that they're doing something where they're underestimating how strong the Trump brand is or something, right? And then he's like diversifying, like Sunbelt states, although I guess the Florida polls were off in a different direction, but like in the Southwest in particular, I don't know if they're not capturing Hispanics or people who newly moved, or the fact that when you have higher voter turnout, then all of a sudden people you are eliminating with your likely voter screen are actually participating. But there have been a lot of elections where Democrats have been underestimated in Nevada, for example, and in California, although California doesn't matter, usually it does matter for the House. And now, you know, in this election, Arizona and Texas may wind up a little low on Democrats, too. So these are kind of fairly consistent patterns. And I hope pollsters won't say, OK, we got the overall margin about right. I hope they will like look and say there seems to be some degree of systematic bias in some subgroups, you know, which you can't always predict ahead of time, except you have had that same bias repeat. Why are we always lowballing the Democrat in Nevada? Why are we always in these like Indiana type races, lowballing the Republican? Because it seems like a little predictable-ish.
Is there anything that we can do in the model to account for that or should do going forward?
No, we won't. And we have a pretty firm view of, well, let me take that back. You know, part of the reason to hedge with priors is to say, okay, here's where we think the error might be. I mean, it was tricky in these like red states with like Donnelly or whatever, because typically Democratic incumbents don't lose a whole lot when Republicans are having a bad year and vice versa. So we've seen the incumbency advantage is very small. Partisanship is a very big factor, right? But in the abstract, that's part of what like the fundamentals model can help you to do. You know, I think the fundamentals model had Jackie Rosen up a point or two in Nevada, which is still too low, but a lot of the polls had her losing instead. And so that's part of it. But look, we don't want to get in a game where we assume that there's a directional bias in the polls, because then you get into a game where like the polls are also trying to correct for that, and then it can wind up like overcorrecting potentially, right? And so we assume as one of our foundational assumptions that nationwide the polls are unbiased. However, they have the potential to be biased in a direction, and you don't know which direction they'll be biased in. That's where the uncertainty comes in. But we don't make terribly fancy assumptions about like, oh, but we know that polls are going to lowball the Republican in Indiana, right? We don't do that, because the minute that a pollster becomes aware that, okay, it seems like we're over at Evan Bayh and now Donnelly and whatever else, right? Then all of a sudden they correct for that, and then something changes, and then you overcompensate or double compensate or whatever else.
Is it fair to say that going forward we would put less weight on incumbency and maybe more weight on the partisanship of the state?
I think we should look at, so the model treats certain variables as dynamic and certain ones as static.
Mm-hmm.
So incumbency we actually treat as dynamic. We use congressional approval ratings to detect that the incumbency advantage is smaller than it once was. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so it was not a huge surprise to the model that incumbency advantage was small. And that's part of why it was optimistic for Democrats in the House and optimistic for Republicans in the Senate.
And on the flip side,
but
is partisanship?
Not really. I mean, as just become more partisan, you see that like the average PVI moves further from the center. But you could have some variable where it's like how much to weight partisanship versus other factors, right? It was kind of like, well, incumbents are semi-exempt from partisanship because they were just elected 2 years ago or 6 years ago. And so how much can things have changed? And apparently the answer is quite a bit, right? So we'll look at that. I think in the race without incumbents, it was kind of on. But something about like the partisanship wasn't weighed enough, I don't think, in the fundamentals model in races with incumbents.
And going back to Matt's original question, is it fair to say that district-level polling in this election was better than state-level polling?
I mean, we want to look at that in a comprehensive way. I mean, look, you had better pollsters on average. Like, one thing. I don't know if it's a good thing or not, right? But because it's hard to do district-level polls, it tends to intimidate the crappy pollsters. And so you only get the Upshots and the Monmouths, the high-quality state pollsters in states that have a relatively small number of congressional districts, like New Hampshire or something. And you get campaign polls, which are done by smart people, are biased, but are biased in ways where you can de-bias it and often get a pretty good outcome. Whereas in the Senate, I mean, there were whole states like Missouri and Indiana, Tennessee to some extent, where like just there weren't like a ton of very reliable polls at all, you know, Montana. I mean, so we're kind of going about like these weird, like mediocre, often GOP aligned polls or like the occasional public poll. And like, but yeah, a lot of those Senate races went without high quality stuff. I mean, I do hope though people look at what Upshot and Monmouth did and said, there is a future for polling. It probably has to rely on, frankly, doing a fair amount of weighting, not W-A-T, but W-E-I-G-H-T, weighting. It probably might mean calling from the voter file where you have information on who these people are, and it might involve just taking a fresh look, not like kind of doing it how you've always done it, but not also like being lulled in by like false senses of like, oh, now we have new technology, right? I mean, you know, the online polls, it's a little bit hard to do. I'm not sure that like there weren't very many online polls that actually ventured out into the states. And the online polls we had, you know, YouGov and Morning Consult, for example, seemed to miss low on what Democrats' eventual margin in the House would be. And so they were not perfectly calibrated either. But look, this is all like, this is what a normal to frankly above average year looks like, where it's like, okay, a few things to iron out, but you're not having these big arguments with people about kind of the future of polling.
But it is fair to say that the Upshots polling helped us and helped anybody trying to forecast this election, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you have accurate polls, then, you know, and as much as we might say our focus should be well calibrated, I mean, the fact is that like...
It depends on the inputs.
Yeah. I mean, it is a lot easier when you get it right and you're saying, oh, actually, our forecasts were a little underconfident, instead of trying to have these big arguments with people, which, by the way, like...
Here we go.
I am hereby declaring the debate settled.
On?
Probabilistic election forecasting works.
Okay.
It works. The arguments against it are dumb, and they've been the same dumb arguments for 10 years. Now, works, what's that mean? Okay, you can have a debate about that. It doesn't mean it's the only thing you should look at. It doesn't mean it's going to, quote-unquote, call every race right. It doesn't mean that's easy. But it basically does what it purports to do pretty well. And if you're wasting bandwidth debating the meaning of these things or abstractions about probability or their value to society, just they're the same boring debates. There are much more interesting things to argue about than the philosophy behind these, because the debates have not become any more sophisticated.
So essentially, as far as covering the horse race and trying to understand what the polls are saying, probabilistic forecasting is the best way to do that. There are also very good ways to tell narrative stories and all different kinds of coverage to do on the
election. And there are lots of interesting, including quantitative questions about the election that election forecast won't tell you, right? Let me actually exempt presidential primaries from that, because that's the next cycle we're going to move into is the early invisible primary stage, where out of all the different phases we deal with, I think quantitative forecasting is the least helpful. The latter stage, where you get into individual states voting and then delegate counting, okay, yeah, game on, right? The early invisible primary stage, I mean, we're going to have a lot of brainstorms about what you can model, what you can't model, how we represent those models, but like, I would leave that as a big exception to where I think that course race coverage can be like forecast and poll driven. I think it's a lot more complicated in the early stage. The rest of it, you know.
You mentioned that there are important quantitative questions that forecasting doesn't answer. What are some examples of those questions?
Well, I mean, the why questions, right? Like, why do people vote? To some extent, the who questions, right? Who votes for what? You know, we don't care who votes for Beto O'Rourke. We care if he wins or loses and how much he wins or loses by.
So this is kind of the questions that you can answer by looking at precinct-level data after the fact and trying to figure out, was it more the Latino vote versus the college-educated white vote or something like that?
Yeah, and we're not, you know, again, we're not, for the model purposes, we are as journalists concerned about it, but for the model, we're not that concerned about the why questions.
Okay, we got a bunch of listener questions about the election night forecast, so that's something I want to dig into. But first, let me tell you that today's episode of Model Talk is brought to you by WeWork. With 260,000 members across nearly 300 locations in 23 countries, WeWork partners with companies of all sizes to provide the space they need when and how they need it. Flexible terms, beautiful spaces, dynamic communities, and a range of privacy and design options create the workspace that's perfect for you today and changes with you tomorrow. WeWork understands that as companies grow, they want a space to call their own, one that provides privacy and autonomy to build their own company culture, but without the commitment of a long-term traditional lease. Visit WeWork.com to find a location near you and learn more about office space products and plans that fit your business's evolving needs. All right, Nate, let's talk about the election night forecast. I'm going to just let the listeners ask the questions here because we got a lot from them and they're good questions. So we'll start off broad. Mark asks, can you talk a little bit about what happened with the live election night forecasts? When Dems' chances dove in the early hours of the night, was that an accurate reflection of the data at that time? Is there a way to make the live models less volatile? Scott added some details, said around 8:30 to 9 p.m., the Republicans' chance of winning the House went from 7% to 60%. So Mark and Scott want to know, WTF? And what adjustments can you make going forward to make the live model less volatile?
So first of all, it's not the job of a model to be volatile or not volatile. It's the job of a model to reflect the data as best you can. And if you feel like you have to build a model so that it either hedges more than it should or is less volatile than it should, which is, I think, a bias a lot of people have, then don't bother building a model, right? Because then you're just injecting your kind of subjective priors.
But we did say, or you did tweet out that night, that the model was being a bit aggressive and you were going to pull it back a little bit.
Let me back up, right? Election night models are tricky because they happen, I mean, election models happen in real time, right? But they happen at like 50 times the speed, right? Mm-hmm. So ordinarily, let's say that we had launched our House forecast in August. When did we launch it? In August? Not July,
yeah,
right?
August.
And you see things and you see it react to new information and it does something that like is surprising or interesting, quote unquote, or disagrees with the consensus or people's intuitions, right? Ordinarily, what we would do is we would say, okay, let's take a look and see if we can understand why it did this, right? Were there bugs? That can happen. Have you kind of adequately tested? It's like an edge case where weird things are happening. Have you gone back and looked at that edge case carefully enough, right? And we go back and look at it, and maybe we'd say, actually, we discovered there was a bug. Maybe we'd say, yeah, I get it's a little weird, but here's why it's happening. And maybe we'd say, look, actually, we think this is an accurate reflection of the state of the world. And sometimes things move a lot, right? When you're on election night, you don't have the time to do that. And so there's like, you know, we literally had a setting in the model. I think it was called like a variable called slowdown. And by default, slowdown is set to zero, but you can turn slowdown higher or lower, kind of like a conductor working a brake pedal or something, right? We do not have any setting like that in our regular models, but you need for election night models because it all happens really fast and because you can have other issues like the data feeds break or are unreliable. You need to be able to intervene in that in the way that you wouldn't for a regular model, which maybe means, you know, maybe it means election night models are not a great thing to have, right? But like basically like we were like, okay, it's shifting a lot toward Republicans and I'll explain why in a moment it did that. And we don't have time to like diagnose why it's doing this. And we're looking at other information, you know, there are betting markets and there are other models, although some of them were on the fritz. And there's other information, like the exit polls seem to be in line with the pre-election polls. And exit polls are not always that accurate, but like
yeah,
they give you some information, you know. So we were like, okay, let's just have them just literally turn a setting so that the model is less aggressive until we kind of get more results in or figure out what's going on, right? And then later on in the night, once it was behaving more in consensus, then we restored that setting to what it was supposed to be originally.
And so why did that happen? Why did it go aggressively in the direction of Republicans around 8:30, 9 o'clock?
Because the model is looking for, first of all, it wants races that are called or nearly complete. And it looks at races. It doesn't look at the races that are going as they're supposed to, right? It looks at how are the toss-ups behaving and are there any surprises? So let's talk about what races at 8:30 or 9 at night there was either calls or enough data to know which way they were going to be called. The first two states to start counting their votes are Indiana and Kentucky. Joe Donnelly in Indiana lost in the end by 5 or 6 points, right? That was a race that I think we actually had him slightly favored, maybe in different versions of the model, I forget, right? But it was either toss-up or lean D, and that goes to Braun, right? So that's like, okay, if you just saw that result, you'd think Democrats are having a rough night. Kentucky 6, the McGrath race, She was ahead for a while, but then Barr pulls ahead and Barr wins. This is, you know, another toss-up district. It might have been like tilting R, but very, very close to the toss-up zone, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Florida Senate. Florida Senate is another race that I think actually of any congressional race, if Nelson winds up losing, which he probably will, and it looked like he was going to lose as of election night at least, then that was a race where it looked like this is not going Democrats' way. And the other congressional races in Florida, Democrats, at least based on what was called early in the night, kind of won the ones they were supposed to and weren't winning a lot of the toss-ups there, right? So it's looking at like, okay, look, Florida, Kentucky, and Indiana are the first states we have in. All of these are going kind of badly for Democrats. And so it looks to me, based on those races, like we're in an environment where things are a couple of points better for Republicans than I thought. And therefore, if you apply that penalty across the board and Democrats are underperforming their polls by 2 points in every state, then it's a toss-up for the House, right? That was the logic behind it. Because there hadn't been, it was pretty late in the evening before we had calls that benefited Democrats in those toss-up races or surprising calls, you know? I mean, like, you know, Barbara Comstock was called early, but that was a model, a race the model already gave her a 90% chance of winning. Doesn't give Democrats very much credit for that, right? Donna Shalala was called early. That was a race where she was not quite a 90% favorite, but a fairly heavy favorite. And so, you know, once you began to get some calls in from toss-ups where Democrats won, then it says, okay, things are going about as the polls expected, and it zoomed up pretty quickly. Once it began to get some surprising calls for Democrats, like the race in Staten Island, I mean, that was pretty late in the evening at that point, right? But then, you know, they started winning some of the more difficult toss-ups or lean R races. Then it shifted a lot and kind of gravitated toward, got back up to 30 or 33 or 35 or 37 seats, right? And so it kind of figured it out. But, you know, I mean, there was a period when the kind of called or almost called races were bad for Democrats. I mean, look, I think there's a spectrum here where, like, there are four levels. And the reason I'm thinking this precisely about it is because I'm writing this piece, right? There are kind of four levels, right, of, like, where the model goes from right to wrong, right? Level one is the model is buggy. It's not working as intended. We don't aren't aware of any bugs. We don't think there was anything
in the election night live forecast.
In the election night forecast, right? Level two is the model is working as designed, but it wasn't well designed. Level three is the model is working as designed. It was reasonably well designed, but it is accounting for certain types of information. Any more comprehensive view could give you a different look. And level four is actually this is the best view of the state of the world as it existed at that time.
And so where would you place the model election?
I think it's probably in category three. I mean, it was working as intended, and I think there are reasons why, like, we weren't trying to make too many inferences from, like, states where only part of the vote was counted. And it also kind of, by the way, also cross-pollinates the House and the Senate. So it's saying these Senate races went badly for Democrats, and so therefore we're going to infer that the House race will go badly too. If we hadn't done that, right, then, you know.
So in the future, do you think for an election night forecast, you would just make it kind of go slower?
Maybe. And I'm not sure if that's right, honestly. I mean, it's not that uncommon for, like, in a football game, a team starts out as an 85-15 favorite, right? And then their team scores the first touchdown, and then it goes to much closer, and then the game recover. I mean, it's not that uncommon, and it did kind of correctly determine very early on that the Senate was, you know, Democrats were toast in the Senate. But I don't know. I mean, there's a question of, like, philosophically, should you just kind of build in a setting that you think is wrong because you don't want to have this kind of false positive on election day? And I don't know, you know, it's hard to know.
It sounds a little bit like you haven't completely decided how you would change it going forward yet.
I mean, again, I think that, like, people are going to have to understand that there is no way around the fact that election night models inherently evolve a level of uncertainty that isn't well reflected in the model itself, right? And the reason for that is that, like, there is a limit on how much you can test for real-world conditions. In a model that updates over the course of months, you have a great hedge against that, which is that you see how it performs no matter how many times you spend thinking about things, right? You always discover things in the kind of first week or first 2 weeks that it's doing wrong. You encounter new problems you didn't realize you're going to have, right? Maybe there's, like, you know, some state introduced ranked choice voting or something, for example, or some new type of poll, right? And you have time to adjust those, and typically what we've done, and we may do it more explicitly, like, kind of next year by having, like, a beta period, right? But typically you have, like, a period of a week or two, you permit yourself to fix things, and then you kind of leave it untouched for the remaining 90% of the time, right? You don't have that diagnostic period in an election night forecast, and you can never get it. You never have enough time to actually go back and assess in real time what's going to happen. And furthermore, these elections don't happen often enough to gain experience. Like if you had an NFL model, okay, there are 16 games a week times, you know, 17 weeks of the regular season, right? So you can say, okay, I have to make adjustments in real time, maybe, you know, whatever, right? So you can learn from that. But like, it's both too fast and too slow. It's too fast in the sense that like, it's too fast to make diagnoses in real time. And it's too slow in the sense that you don't collect enough data to actually improve at it all that much, right? You get one crack at it every 2 years or something.
I mean, do you think we'll have an election night forecast in 2020?
I think there are a lot of people who demand an election night forecast. It's not my favorite thing I work on. You know, I think it's something, maybe a little bit more candid than I should, right? It's something that, like, every time I've worked in a newsroom, there is, and again, all these newsrooms, you know, NBC had a version, Fox News had a version, whatever else, right? CNN had a version with Harry that Harry kind of helped work on, you know. All these newsrooms have a huge desire for it because they want to be differentiated on election night. And, you know, I think they are interesting and informative, but, like, look, there are times when I really do think, with respect to our pre-election model, there are times and there are exceptions, but there are a lot of times when I really do think this is the answer to the question that you want to have, right? The answer to how is it going in the horse race is our model. And if there are things our model is not accounting for, then, you know, we should have added them to the model. But, you know, but most of the time, like, that's kind of a fairly bottom line answer. I wouldn't say that for election night models. I'd say this is a provisional back of the envelope sketch that is pretty good, but like it's definitely like just a level of existential uncertainty removed from a model where you have time to pull that lever and know why you're doing it instead of saying, okay, let's kind of hit the brake here just because we're not certain how well our instrumentation is working.
I mean, do you think we should consider not doing it at all?
Do I think we should consider not doing it?
Yeah.
I mean, we should consider it, and we probably will do it. I mean, it's kind of fun.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, but, like, I do think, look, I mean, head fakes happen all the time in probabilist. I mean, it's not like, you know, the basic logic, again, is that, like, the first two or three or four kind of called results were not good for Democrats, and it's supposed to be adjusting for that, you know. But I don't know. I think it should probably have, my intuition is it probably should have gone from 85 down to 65 and then bounce back. I'm not sure I buy that. She's gone all the way to 50-50.
So one last question on this from a listener, and then we're going to move to some broader questions from listeners. Alex asks, you all talk about the narrative that emerged on election night, and he's referring to Democrats not doing as well or it not being really a blue wave. And then he says, but you don't take any position on 538's own agency in creating those narratives with your, by your own admission, overly aggressive live results. Had the model not been aggressive, don't you think the narrative on election night would have been different? So essentially,
no.
Did we shape that narrative of
no,
there not
I've
being a
I've heard this
blue
criticism,
wave?
And I think it's dumb.
Okay.
Because the news media cares about called races, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they care about these high-profile races that are identified ahead of time as being bellwethers.
Mm-hmm.
And like, our model was not reacting to some obscure boutique hipster congressional district in Louisiana or something, right? It was saying these high profile races that everyone said to watch early. So races in
Kentucky
Indiana, Florida, and Virginia, which went okay. Although that like Dave Brat race, which eventually got called for Democrats, didn't get called till late in the night. And it also became kind of clear early in the night that Democrats were not going to win the Senate because Joe Donnelly was losing. Bill Nelson was maybe losing. And, like, they have to have everything go right in the Senate for them to win. And things are going wrong, you know.
So essentially that narrative would have emerged with or without 538 specific election night forecast because all of the networks were focused on those races anyway, is what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, like, maybe at the margin it contributes. But, like, but I don't know. I mean, people are trying to interpret stuff in real time. In some ways what the model is doing is trying to, like,
be systematic about it.
Be more rigorous and systematic, but like, yeah, I mean, you know, kind of three states is enough of a trend for you to wonder. I mean, you know, I mean, that's, there's another scenario where like, where all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, that is the first sign of something going wrong. If I had woken you up at 8:30 p.m. on election night, or whenever it was, 8:45 when the GOP probability peaked, and I said, well, here's the news. Amy McGrath lost. Donnelly's going to lose by 6 points, and we think Bill Nelson's going to lose and Gillum's going to lose, right? And Barbara Comstock won and Donna Shalala won, but none of these toss-up races have been called for Democrats yet, right? If I had woken you up at that point in time and you had been sleeping, then what would you think, right? I don't think it would be unreasonable for you to infer that, like, there's some downside for Democrats here.
All right. So hopefully we answered everyone's questions about the election night forecast, and we're going to move on to some broader questions. But before we do that, let me tell you that today's podcast is also brought to you by Upstart. Debt. Some people have a lot, some people have a little, and the vast majority of us have some. But trying to get on the path to financial freedom can look pretty bleak when you have high interest debt. And if your FICO score isn't great, it can make breaking out of that revolving debt cycle harder than it needs to be. Thankfully, Upstart is revolutionizing the process of personal lending. Upstart offers personal loans, but they're not like the ones your bank or credit union provides. That's because Upstart goes beyond the traditional FICO score when assessing your credit worthiness. For instance, they actually reward you based on your education and your job history in the form of a smarter interest rate. 2 minutes is all it takes to go online and find out your Upstart rate. Checking your Upstart rate is always free, and it won't affect your credit. Hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes 2 minutes, and it won't affect your credit. That's upstart.com/politics. Let's move on to some other listener questions. And we'll start with Helene. She asks, looking back, how do you feel about the way you chose to display probabilities in the model this year, i.e. odds rather than percentages? Do you think it helped people grasp that 80% should not be rounded up to 100%?
I think it helped. We might want to fiddle a little bit with some of the numbers. So, like, I think there are some numbers that are intuitive, like 4 and 5 or 1 and 6. If you get like a 2 and 9 or something, right? So numbers ending in 7 and 9 are a little tricky, or 11, or I don't know if it used 11 or not, right? But like, so how that displays. But I think, you know, it does a couple of good things. One, it reminds people that, like, you know, a 1 in 5 chance is a chance, and it will occur 1 in 5 times, right? Mm-hmm. Also, like, because it uses like rounder numbers, it means that you don't like worry as much about like the swing from 72% to 73%. I mean, there were times when, like, I think at the start of the year, we were very strict about using those probabilities or those fractions, right? And then we began introducing probabilities a little bit more. So, but, like, I think it's a helpful innovation.
And I think just coming off of 2016 helped people too. Like, they had in mind that you shouldn't round up.
Yeah, look, actually, in fact, more than half voters did not expect Democrats to take the House, which is an interesting point, because I think the notion that, like, oh, people thought that Hillary was sure to win because that's what polls said, I think that's bullshit. And the reason why it's bullshit is because this year the Democrats were, in our view, less equivocal about Democrats winning the House than they were about Hillary. In 2012, Obama had a much clearer chance in the polls, much safer than Hillary was, right? But I think people have perceptions and then they confirm them against the polls. And so it's a lot easier to get people to pay attention to probability when their prior is that, like, oh, things always go badly for Democrats, and so of course there's a chance Republicans win. You can't take anything for granted, right? Mm-hmm. I think in some sense, some of the criticisms have it reversed, where people are like, okay, well, people take these probabilities very seriously, and so that dictates how they think, right? I think it's almost the reverse, where it's like, people have very strong priors, and that interprets how they see the probabilities, right? And so in a race where, like, Democrats are paranoid about losing and things going badly, then you don't even have to sell, like, the 1 in 5 chance that much. Like, oh my God, that's really high, you know? Whereas in election, we're like, oh, it's Hillary and she's against Donald Trump and these polls are always right. And so 20%, yeah, they're just hedging, or 30% actually. They're just hedging to be careful. And I know that isn't really going to happen, you know? So mm-hmm. It's like, yeah.
Context matters. Okay, let's move on to Zach.
Way to sum up my somewhat incoherent but deep thought with context matter. Thank you for that kicker.
That's my job. All right, so let's move on to Zach. He asks, early on, I believe Nate had said the classic forecast was the default assumption. Later, the deluxe seemed more favored and indeed was the most correct. Why the switch, and should we focus on the deluxe model going forward?
So they're all our babies. And, you know, which, you
we
know,
love them
you should focus
equally
on the one that was the most accurate. I'm just kidding. So deluxe accounts for Cook political and other forecasts, right? I mean, the incentives change a little bit over the course of an election cycle, where at first the philosophy is a little bit more important, where it's like saying, what's a purely kind of data driven, quote unquote, objective view of the race look like as a benchmark, right? And that's the priority. It's mostly the priority, right? It's like, so you're willing to sacrifice a little bit of accuracy for philosophical consistency. Once you get down to like the week before election day, then it's a little bit like,
yeah, I just want to be right.
I just want to be right. And, you know, I don't want to like be hanging my hat on all these weird calls, or like a lot of other evidence points in a different direction would characterize the race differently. And so that's kind of behind it. And also at the end, like, So one of the challenges with Deluxe is, like, when you're backtesting the model, you know, Dave Wasserman at Cook Political or Nathan Gonzalez or whatever at Inside Elections, you know, they're making decisions on their own and are not, like, consulting you. And that is better if they have an independent evaluation. By the end, there's this whole dialogue where the other forecasters are looking at what you say and they can adjust their ratings as a result, and then you incorporate their ratings. So that's why it's like, as a default version, we don't want that feedback loop to occur. And so therefore, it's like at the end, then we'll say, okay, the ratings are kind of set now, and we're going to go ahead and use this version that we think is going to get a few extra races right. But, I mean, probably what we'll do in the future, too, right, is kind of say...
Stick to classic,
and then in the last week or two, we'll kind of incorporate more Deluxe.
All right, next question. This was just a bunch of people on Twitter. They wanted to know how you felt about how the model considered fundraising in the end.
Great.
So in the end, the fundraising numbers were just
awesome,
totally beyond any historic precedent. And we had conversations on this podcast about whether we should just average them in like another fundamental, or whether they pointed to Democrats far outperforming their polls.
I mean, in the end, the polls kind of caught up to the numbers, right? But our model in like mid-October, once those fundraising numbers kicked in, you know, that's when Classic was kind of when other people were saying, oh my God, the Democrats' ceiling is getting lower, and this Kavanaugh thing, I'm not sure if it's going well for them.
In that voice, is that how they were like whispering it into a microphone?
But the fundraising numbers came in, and Classic was like, yeah, screw this, guys. I mean, like, you have all these Democratic candidates with like 2-to-1 advantages in swing seats. I mean, that's going to have some type of an effect. Maybe it will overestimate it. Maybe we'll underestimate it. But no, I think the fundraising was a key reason why it honed in on the Democrats' advantage in the House more quickly than other people did. In fact, it's important enough that they probably think, you know, we might look at it, but not for the reason like, oh, should it be in the model, but for the reason like, okay, should we weight in-state contributions more heavily? Should we give some consideration to money from outside groups? Maybe you count that, but at some discounted rate. But the inclusion of fundraising was important. And I think the arguments for like just kind of ignoring it were weird. You know, I think this is kind of the narrative where like people were afraid to say things are going well for Democrats because they don't want to be burned like they were in 2016. You know, I mean, the most obvious implication of Democrats outraising Republicans 2-to-1 is that their voters are really enthusiastic and their candidates have a ton of money and so they're going to close really strongly in these swing districts. I mean, that was the kind of obvious, straightforward Occam's razor interpretation, and that seems to have been more or less correct. I mean, we'll still go back and kind of see in individual districts like how predictive was fundraising or not, but like it seemed like that did a pretty good job.
All right, let's move on to rapid fire, and then we will wrap things up. So, as briefly as possible, Chris asks, what did Nate think about being in the fancy ABC hologram room? How was it? The epicenter of mainstream media on election night. Holograms galore.
It was very cool in some ways, right? I mean, because you really are like in the epicenter. I mean, that's as mainstream as it gets, right? And they did, I think, a very good job of incorporating 538's forecast over the course of the night. You know, it does mean that like this kind of symptom of like having like different things going on, like part of the reason like why we just had to turn the slowdown setting on the election night model and not go in with a little more confidence, right? It's just because literally you're being asked to do TV hits every 5 or 10 minutes and like you're getting makeup and blah, 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 right? You have a producer in your ear. And so it's like until later in the evening when things settled in, but like that first hour was like right when like you're just trying to get your bearings a little bit.
Okay, next question. Based on the model, and maybe you can give an estimate because I know that you haven't looked at all of this data yet. Based on the model, what would the Senate look like if the whole Senate were up for a vote this past election?
That's a creative question. I thought about looking at that, and then I got lazy and decided to do some NBA stuff instead.
If you're going to pull a number out of thin air.
I think Democrats would win 52 or something Senate seats. I mean, they, you know, so if you look at like how they do in the average Senate race, if you pull out incumbency, it looks like they would have won the average neutral state, the average purple state with no incumbent by like 6 or 7 points, right? I mean, you didn't have one of those exactly, right? If you had an open seat race in Wisconsin or something, right? But instead you had incumbents running. But yeah, I mean, look, the Senate was consistent. I'll put it like this. The Senate results were consistent with the House results. And the House results are a world where Democrats won the popular vote by 7-ish, maybe 7.5, maybe 8, probably 7-ish and a half points. And that's about what you saw in the Senate, too, only with a small incumbency advantage. And that hurt Democrats because they had so many incumbents running in the Senate.
I think we have time for one more rapid fire question. will there be a house model in 2020? And have you already done most of the work for it? Or do you build models from scratch every election year?
Yeah, there's going to be a house model. The house is more interesting than the presidency, guys. I guess you have to bleep that. But like, yeah.
We'll see if you still think that
the house is the best.
Come 2020. But, okay, more importantly.
You know what the most boring one is? You know what's boring?
What?
The Senate's boring.
Okay.
No, I mean, look, this is one of the challenges we face in 2020 is like the House, the Senate, and the presidency are all potentially interesting. But yeah, no, look, we took a lot of time on the. So we hadn't built a House model since 2010, and we hadn't really kind of gone through and carefully looked at the Senate model. And I'd say since like probably also since 2010 or something, right? So there was a lot of work done on the model this year, and it was done in a way, this is technical, right? But it was done in a way that it's more replicable because there is a tendency to like go back and start over, right? It's like, oh, it's been 2 years since I did this, and like I've learned a lot more, and like I don't like my old code because I'm a better coder now, and let me just do it from scratch, right? This year, the intent was not to do that. This year was the intent was to build the code in a way that it was just quite a bit more robust, and I think we made a lot of practical and philosophical changes I thought were really sensible. And so my hope is that I have a little bit less work on the congressional side in 2020, and also that we'll get those forecasts out a bit earlier.
There you go. Well, I think that means we've come to the end of our last model talk for a while.
I feel like these segments always are like, this is 538 at its most prickly. You know, it's most honest in some ways, but
it's 538 raw. That's what you come to this podcast for.
Okay, I'm not going to use a voice.
All right. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
And
this was the final 2018 edition of
Model Talk. All right. Well, hopefully you're going to enjoy all of this extra time that you have now that the election is over. And as you mentioned, we will have a Democratic primary model to you sometime.
Next week.
All right. I'm Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Send us any questions that you have. We'll still have the regular podcast on Monday and others throughout the week. Send them on Twitter or at podcasts@538.com. Also, go rate us on Apple Podcasts or tell your friends about the show. That's it from us, and we will see you on Monday.